Ross Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, Jane Thompson, has taught at Chester High School, at Greaterford Prison, and has served on a panel hearing cases involving juvenile offenders. She has seen firsthand what's been called the school-to-prison pipeline. For the last 3 years, she's been teaching creative writing for the Greaterford Prison Literacy Project to some 20 inmates, and says she often wished the prisoners could talk to the young people she met who had gotten in trouble. Thompson asked the inmates to write letters to their younger selves, and what they expressed were painful memories of remorse, loss, bad decisions, and trauma. They are now a book titled Letters to My Younger Self. We asked her to tape some of the inmates reading their letters and poems and essays so that we could play them today on Radio Times. Jane Thompson joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. She's a creative writing and English senior lecturer at Widener University, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me begin with this dedication, and you write, or the book says, this book is dedicated to Frank Turner, December 29, 1995 to October 17, 2013, a kind and intelligent young man who was murdered in Chester, Pennsylvania. We hope this book will reach out to youth like Frank and his killer to prevent further loss and suffering. A very powerful way to begin the book, but it's also a very poignant way as well. Who was Frank Turner?
Frank, I met Frank not this summer, but the summer before. He was coming to Widener through Chester Education Foundation, and I'd been teaching in a program for Chester Education Foundation for about 7 years, and he was in my class. And I used to do have these little dominoes that I would give out for particularly intelligent comments, and he was always saying such sweet things to others and always complimenting others on their comments and all this, and often I'd wind up giving him a domino for saying something really, really sweet. And and I kind of got kind of close to Frank. But then I went to Chester High School last October, and I found out that he had been killed.
Murdered.
Yeah, and it had involved drugs and drug dealing. And I was just blown away by that. And at the time, I was working with the men at Greaterford in my class, getting this book together and working with the publishers Tom Kennedy and Walt Cummins. And I said, can we dedicate the book to Frank? Because he's exactly the audience that we were trying to reach.
Where did this idea of letters to my younger self, where did that come from?
You know, so often I'd go in and to teach my class at Greaterford, and they would ask me, so, you know, what's going on in your life? And I'd say, well, you know, I'm hearing these cases of juvenile offenders in Chester, and I would tell them, you know, little pieces of them and about how upset I'd get. When I first met the men, actually, I had just finished a full year at Chester High School. And I was still at Widener at the time, but I taught one class a day every day. And I lost three of my own students.
Killed?
Well, not killed, but they entered the juvenile justice system. And they just simply disappeared. One of them I could find no trace of. And I thought, oh, gosh, this is how it happens, isn't it? You know, one day they're in your class. The one guy loved poetry so much. He loved Langston Hughes like no other. I'd come in and I'd put the poems on the desk to get them kind of situated, and he would start rapping whatever Langston Hughes I'd put on the desk. And he was so good and so smart and very, very sweet, often trying to help me organize the students. And, you know, he'd say, come on, sit down for. And he had kind of the presence that I think I didn't have there. And
Was it the prisoners who thought of this idea, or you and the prisoners together thinking about how to perhaps reach these young people?
Yeah. You know, and it's certainly not a new idea. People have done this kind of thing before. And so we had this idea that they would write about a time between ages 11 through 17, which is the age of the young offenders that I see, about a time where they made a decision that had negative consequences, even if it's just kind of, you know, that bothers their conscience later. But and then we decided that they would write these letters, that they would speak to themselves at a time before. And it was for the men. I mean, for the young people, certainly was the intended audience. But I kind of think it's kind of broader than that.
Well, I would think for the people that wrote these essays and poems, and also for the fellow inmates part of this program.
I think so. You know, when I started it, I remember thinking the men in my class, I often felt, were very hard on themselves. And I know, yes, they're in prison, and, you know, there's some crime probably that had been committed, but they were often very, very hard on themselves, and I thought maybe they could come to a greater understanding of what had happened in their own lives, and maybe find some empathy for themselves as well, the kind of empathy that I saw them having for these young people they'd never met. They'd get really, really upset when we'd be sitting in class and I would tell them something, you know, and they would try to fix it. I noticed they're all fixers.
Yeah. Well, let's play an excerpt, and this is Haroon F. We don't know their last names. He's an inmate at Greaterford, and he's here reading an excerpt of his essay. It's called Betrayal, and it begins where he describes being in a gang at the age of 12. This incident happened when he was 15 years old. He goes to a gang member's house. He's looking for someone named Dady. Let's pick this up right where the poem begins.
I needed to get drunk immediately. As I stood there talking to Dady, I began to feel trapped. In the midst of all this was a girl lying on the bed naked. I knew her. She was about 13, but she was big for her age. She looked more like 16 or 17. She was just lying there, seemingly oblivious to the whole situation. I wanted to break and run, but I knew I couldn't. Finally, Dady told me, "Go ahead and get some." I felt like the whole world was looking at me, and my reaction would validate or undermine my manhood and status. All the while, this was something I really, really didn't want to do. I'd never done it before. I thought about how disgusted I felt when I heard dudes talking about how they pulled a train on some girl. Now here I was in the middle of one. My hesitation was becoming obvious as a voice from somewhere in the room called out, "Go ahead, man." I looked in her face as I walked towards the bed. She gave no indication that she cared one way or the other about the situation. I took my hat and jacket off and handed them to someone. I always thought I betrayed myself in this situation for not having the courage to stand on what I believed in and walked away. I'm 69 years old now, and those memories still haunt me today.
And again, that's Haroon F. Reading an essay, part of this book called Letters to My Younger Self. He's an inmate at Greaterford Prison. And tell us about Haroon. What should we know about him? And again, that's such a, it's a powerful story of regret, of doing something he clearly didn't want to do, and he did it.
Yeah. You know, I actually don't call Haroon. I call him by his last name because he has just incredible dignity. I always tell him he's kind of kingly as he's sitting there. He's very self-possessed and very thoughtful and doesn't say much in class, but when he does, it is spot on. Mm. You know, and his dignity just always kind of comes through for me.
Did some young people in Chester have a chance to read Haroon's poem or his essay here?
Yes. I used that, in the summer course, actually, this summer. There's been about 55 kids in Chester so far. The book came out the end of May, and about 55 children in Chester have read it. Some at Malvern Prep have also read the book, and some Widener students as well. And this is one that really gets people.
Well, he's extremely honest.
Yeah.
And, you know, describing doing something he really, really, really didn't want to do.
Yeah. Yeah. He really didn't. And I think again, he shows such incredible empathy for the young woman, and that it's still haunting him today, I think speaks volumes about the kind of man he is.
Let me play another. This is a poem by inmate D. Sadiq P., reading a poem called Blue Sea, and it's a poem in response to Etheridge Knight's Belly Song. Let's give it a listen.
A poem in response to Etheridge Knight Belly Song. D. Sadiq P. Deep Blue Sea. What's up, son? I see you, but you don't see me. Damn, my bad. This ain't about me seeing you or you seeing me. I'm not talking about the sea that separates a piece of land from another. This is about the sea of deep misery that has us locked up, boxed up, like the cargo in boats that floats over the seas to lands that seems like make-believe to me, you see. I can't be with you to hold you and mold you like a captain and his first mate. But at any rate, I can try to guide and steer you from falling into the sea of never-ending abyss. No fish, no coral, no islands, but plenty of salt that comes from the water that leaks from the eyes of those who secretly shed tears out of fear of never escaping the abyss. The abyss, I say it again, because it's not your friend. This water, not blue or green, that seems to come to life when you enter the like movie screens with beautiful colors that shake and shimmer as the sun illuminates every glimmer. Nah, son, this is the Black Sea, the deep, dark place where you don't want to be, where everyone looks and feels like me, full of pain and despair, in a sea of stale air. Take heed to my words, or this will be your destiny, because the road you're heading down has already got the best of me. So I hope you see what I didn't see and follow the Blue Sea and not the Black Sea that has swallowed me.
And again, a reading from this new book called Letters to My Younger Self. That's D. Sadiq P., as he is described in this book. And to you, Jane, what should we know about him?
Oh, one time I was sitting in class and he turned to me and he said, "I worry about you out there." He said, what happens to you? You just seem to me like you're like something, you know." He was just very worried about me out in the world, and he's trying to imagine, I guess, me negotiating, you know, all this trouble that I think he sees in the world. And he has a number of pieces in the book, and in so many of them, he's really worried about his son.
Clearly, and he's worried about his son in this poem as well, about the sea, you know, the dark sea or the other sea.
Yeah.
And how old is he?
He is, I think his late 30s now. Yeah, late 30s. And very, very, you know, empathetic man. And very, very smart. And that's the thing. I think sometimes when we think about prison, you know, I think people probably picture me as kind of going in there and teaching them something and that, you know, that they're in this great need. And they are in great need. And they're in great need for people from the outside to come in, because what the prison does is it really takes them out of society. Even when they get out of prison, they're often kind of out of society without the ability to vote or live in public housing if they need it or to get food stamps and all those kind of things. So it's very much an alienating situation. But I've learned a tremendous amount from them. And a number of them are in a group called the Greaterford Think Tank, and this group of intellectuals, and Sadiq is one of those.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, also get back to some of these poems and essays from this book called Letters to My Younger Self. Our guest is Jane Thompson. She edited the book. We're going to take a short break and get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center joins you in supporting WHYY. With over 20 community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Penn's Heart and Vascular Center is committed to delivering advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PENN. Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Paul Strand, Master of Modern Photography, his first retrospective in over 40 years. Paul Strand's photographs include candid street portraits, abstract work, and explorations of the American Southwest, Europe, and Africa. The exhibition showcases Strand's use of photography as a means of understanding and describing humanity and the modern world through January 4th. Tickets and info at philamuseum.org.
Natural Lands Trust supports WHYY and is hosting the Cheslin Chase for Open Space on October 25th. This 10K, 5K, and 1.5-mile trail race through the woodlands and meadows of Cheslin Preserve in Unionville, Chester County, will culminate in a post-race party with food and beer from Victory Brewing Company and live music by the Mojo Gypsies. Details at natlands.org/Cheslin Chase. Natural Lands Trust. Land for life.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Jane Thompson, and she's a senior lecturer in English and creative writing at Widener University. She began running a workshop for the Prison Literacy Project at Graterford Prison, and that's Pennsylvania's largest maximum security prison. This was back in February 2011. She's also a youth aid panelist for the Center for Resolutions, and we've been playing selections of this book that she edited. It's called Letters to My Younger Self. The inmates at Graterford read and recorded some of these essays and poems. The idea is trying to help young people and to keep them out of the school-to-prison pipeline, as it's called. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Had you ever been in a prison before, February 2011?
I had once. In the neighborhood I grew up in, Greensboro, North Carolina, and I lived in the mill area of the neighborhood, and one of my friends, riddled with drugs, the neighborhood, and one of my friends was high and killed his father.
Wow.
Yeah. And so the very first time I ever decided to go, I was only 16 years old. And I was very, very nervous about it, but I went because I thought I wanted to go see him. But when I got there, there were all these big doors like they have it in Graterford, of course, the middle doors. But I got inside, and he had gotten into a fight with someone, and I wasn't actually able to see him. And then I never tried again. And I always kind of regretted that.
So what's it like to enter Graterford?
Oh, the very first time on my ride up there, I was in the Inside Out program, and I was being trained by Lori Pompa.
Sure, from Temple University.
Yeah, and she's quite wonderful. And I was driving up the big driveway, and if you've never seen Graterford, it's beautiful all around it. It's beautiful, Perky Oman Park and Creek and, all these trails. And there's a lot of land right before you get up there. And there was a man on horseback with a rifle just sitting there on a horse, and there are all these men in the field working, and it gave me the shivers, to be quite honest with you. That was my first moment. I thought, oh gosh, what era is this? Uh-huh. And then I drove on up, and we were all very nervous. I'd been very careful about what I wore, everything, and we were all very nervous because a lot of us were going in for the very first time. We didn't want to break any rules or get, Lori Pompa's group in any trouble. And there are a lot of rules that we have to, be careful of.
And when you're teaching a class, is it just you and the inmates? Is there a guard sitting nearby, for instance?
No, there's no guard. And it's just me, and we sit in one of the classroom rooms. And I'm really glad that the prison allows us to do that, because a guard in the room would kind of change the dynamic.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, everybody needs to trust one another very, very much and feel that they can kind of open up. And that would mean everybody. That would mean the guard would need to join us, and that may not happen. I'm not sure.
I do want to play another selection, but I'm curious about what's the response of the inmates as they hear each other's stories. And I'm sure they, they read them to each other and worked on them together.
The very first one is by Chris, who the piece you're going to play in a moment, Barricades. He was the first one to read, and I thought, I don't know if I'm going to be able to sit through this without crying. And it's about an experience he had with sexual abuse.
Right.
And I thought, if that's not the bravest thing I've ever seen in my life, I don't know what is. Chris is this really big, strong, muscular man. He kind of actually can't fit in the desk completely.
He's
comfortably.
So big.
Yeah, yeah, he's just this big, but with a very sweet, soft voice. And he started reading this thing, and here's this, giant, gentle giant of a man reading this piece about being a child and saying things like, he says at the very end of it, be strong, Christopher, get your full education and become a success to prove all those people wrong that said you'd never amount to anything. Life is too short, my little self. Make good use of it, okay? I love you so very, very much. I always will. Hmm. And the rest of the men were absolutely, completely moved. And it was at that, that's the reason I put that one first. It's because he was the brave one who went and set the bar for everybody.
Well, let's listen to, and this is Greaterford inmate Christopher R.W.M. It's a poem called Barricades. Let's listen.
Page 112. Christopher R.W.M. Barricades. I remember when Papa passed. Grandma hated life. Papa hated Grandma and Grandpa. Mama had Ange and me out of wedlock. Brother hated me. I learned to hate brother. I remember my pain and hating. It taught me not to love, not to trust. Brick walls are to keep positives out, negatives in. I became a castle of brick walls, moats, and drawbridges. Emotions lay in a heap of decaying souls. I remember never feeling, never loving, never touching, never trying, never trusting, never opening, never closing. Never, 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 ever lowering broken drawbridges. I remember love's pointed blade piercing chest, ribs, heart, soul, spirit, life, and God. I remember darkened crawl spaces, rats chewing, pets being swallowed by hungry dogs. I remember hospitals, needles, emergency rooms, asthma, heart pains, growing, withering, seeing death, remembering life as an elderly child. I remember being in my prime at age 5, being senile at the age of 13, being born again at the age of 19, living, dying, breathing, waking up from false stories of Cat in the Hat, Mickey Mouse Club, and Captain Noah. I remember the metallic taste of blood, still tasteless to a tasteful palate. I remember seeing America for the first time, seeing liberty change, seeing monkeys covering holes in walls, in society, in prisons, in leaders, in me, in my family, and perpetuating God. I remember becoming free. I remember being the slave of Lady Liberty, a plantation not residing in New York, but in the middle of West Philly. I remember the bombardments of flaming arrows from moats, from drawbridges, and from the clay and mortar that binds me to internal and external prisons. I remember seeing my face on other living beings, even on the hungry snouts of beasts. I remember crying. I remember dying. I remember not feeling, never loving, never trusting, never being free, and never allowing humanity in the demolished cell I prefer to as my human vessel. I remember wood chips from doors, lacerated faces, blood-red eyes filled with anger, hate, revenge, malice, and brimmed over with maddened tears. I remember water mixed with life-giving blood running over bathtubs, tears mingled with iodine and ivory soap. I remember life and death courting, giggling on my front porch, creeping through the front door, making shushing sounds. I remember letting go of the ropes that connected me to humanity. I remember tumbling, flailing, and grasping for ghosts that once walked the earth as blind and deaf elders. I always remember.
And again, that's a Christopher R.W.M., a poem called Barricades. Part of this, Letters to My Younger Self, it's an anthology of writings by incarcerated men at Greaterford Prison, and it's edited by our guest, Jane Thompson, who has taught creative writing at Greaterford, and that is just such a powerful poem, and this sort of repeat of, I never remember feeling, never loving, never touching, never trying, never trusting, and that's kind of a theme that he plays over. He also says, I remember being in my prime at age 5, being senile at age 13, being born again at 19, living, dying, breathing, waking up from the false stories of Cat in the Hat.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I think this is an amazing poem. Students at Widener often point to this one as one that just that they think an awful lot and admire an awful lot. I visited a number of classrooms, and often this is the one that people come back to. Yeah.
And as you said, when he wrote it, read it at Greaterford, there were tears shed by the other men in the writing group.
You know, they're very, for none of these were people unaffected. You know, I think to hear things that, you know, they know each other.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these guys were actually kind of handpicked by Paul J.P., who's in the book numerous times, and who really was instrumental in getting this whole thing together. So, yes, they know each other, but I don't think they knew each other like this.
Right. But do you think there was something about writing that allowed them to be more vulnerable with each other?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I think that there's that space that comes between you and the writing. You know, at first it's just you and the piece, and you're by yourself. And I think that they felt very free, and they had this idea that they wanted to reach young people. And I think that's where an awful lot of their feeling that, okay, I can be vulnerable because it's not just for me, it's for these other people. And I really want them to know. I want them to, if they recognize themselves in something, that they wanted them to be moved.
Let me give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at @whyyradiotimes, and tell us what you think as you listen to some of these poems. How long has this prison literacy project been going? Is this something that you started, or has it been there for a while at Greater Fort?
Oh, no, it was already started. I think it was started in, like, 1998, I believe. And a man named Rob Bender, who's recently retired, was instrumental in getting me through to teach a class for the project. But it basically takes people who are struggling with reading and writing skills and brings them in and works with them. Now, that's certainly not the men
that I was going to say, not here.
No, not at all. Though you might be surprised, a lot of them talk about being functionally illiterate when they entered prison, a number of them. In the book, talk about having, you know, skills that really needed some refining, and they have worked so incredibly hard.
Wow. And a number of these are in response to other people's poems, Charles Simic being one. So obviously they're reading other people's poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Is that part of what you teach them?
It is, yeah. I do that an awful lot at Widener, and I did it here too. Some of my favorites, and we were lucky enough that either the estates or the actual poets themselves were so excited by the projects, they said, yeah, go ahead and reprint. Mm-hmm. But I use that a lot, and I'll give them a line to respond to, or I'll tell them to do it in the way that Two Dogs by Charles Simic was written or something like that.
Well, in fact, we have Termaine J.H. Reading a poem in response to Charles Simic's Two Dogs, as you just said. And I'll just set it up. He begins by saying, passing by the stoop, an old wino with a cheap bottle of wine told me he had a story to tell me that he thought I ought to hear. And it goes on. It's sort of a wild story that involves Hannibal and all of that. And I do want to pick it up about halfway through the poem, and let's see how he finishes it.
It made me remember the stories my grandmother told, how black men, women, and children were enslaved, bought, and sold, raped, lynched, mutilated, degraded, castrated, segregated, assassinated, nearly annihilated. Have we really made it? Have the promise from over 2,000 years ago come true? Black president of a powerful nation who looked just like you. Black queen of media, black entrepreneurs. Millionaires and billionaires, but still can't feed the poor. I swear, if Hannibal was here, he would shake his head in despair from the disenfranchisement to which his people clings. Whatever happened to, I have a dream, and lift every voice and sing. Martin Luther King's dream could be Barack's reality, but Malcolm's inspiration and revolutionary qualities died when the men turned on their own with brutality. Tupac against Biggie, Karanga against Huey, the futility behind it all. The old wino on the stoop brought me back to reality when he stood tall, swaying and offered me a swig of his cheap beer. I guzzled, wiped my mouth, and said, I have a story to tell. Would you like to hear?
And that's Two Old Winos, an excerpt of that. And this is the very first poem that he ever wrote.
Very first. Yeah, and he's quite a writer. He's also an ordained minister. He has trained for that while at Greaterford. He's not allowed to be a minister within the prison, but he wrote a wonderful play for his graduation ceremony, and I went to the graduation ceremony of what he would do if he was able to be a minister in the prison, which I think he'd be quite a minister in the prison. He's got an awful lot of life in him, that's for sure.
You have taught children, high school children in Inchester. You've also taught at Widener. How different is it teaching a class of inmates? Is it different?
Well, you know, it was different in that when I go to the prison, sometimes I would think, you know, at Chester High, for the first month and a half, I couldn't get them to actually all sit down at once. So that was I forgot what it's like to be 15 years
exactly.
old.
Exactly,
yes. I'd be thinking, are you kidding me? And so I'd be chasing them around the room quite literally. And at Greaterford, there's always this seat of honor for me when I'd get there. And they'd be like, here's your seat, Jane. And completely, you know, always having their work done, more than their work done, reading outside of class constantly, really thinking about the things that we talked about the night, you know, or the week before. And certainly, you know, my other classes are like that too. But one thing that I had a problem with, because they were adults and men, and maybe it was partly the place I was in, I had a problem taking kind of more authority in the class, which is what they wanted me to do. And I think, you know.
They taught you that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think they did. I think they did. Yeah, they would. I mean, they would just look me straight in the face and say, "You're in charge," and I'm like, "I don't know if I want to be in charge."
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
How much do you know about their backgrounds? I mean, is it sort of what they tell you, or were you given information about why they were at Greaterford?
That's a good question. I only know what they've told me, and I could look up more information on them, but I've chosen not to.
Why?
They're my students. You know, and they're human beings who have a right to their privacy, and I'm not the court. You know, and the reason that they're there really isn't my business unless they decide to make it my business. And so I've just kind of, Sadiq, whose piece you heard a few minutes ago, said that he really kind of was happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, when he made me laugh once, he said, "I'm not going to ask you about all the bad things you've ever done." And I thought, gosh, I hope not. I'll be here all night.
I think for, you know, as you kind of alluded to earlier, sometimes teaching is, you know, the teacher in front of the class and the students, you know, diligently taking notes or whatever. But this sounds like a much more interactive kind of classroom.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, Lori Pompa, through Inside Out training, really focuses on the idea of bell hooks, of decentering authority, about trying not to be such an authority figure in the classroom. And so I certainly would try that there, and I tried it at Chester High as well. Mm-hmm. It really took a couple months before the kids kind of realized what I was trying to do, and it was a lot of rebellion. Then when it finally clicked, it really, really clicked. Yeah.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Again, Jane Thompson is our guest. She's a senior lecturer in English and Creative Writing at Widener University, and she's been running a workshop for the Prison Literacy Project at Greaterford Prison. Again, that's Pennsylvania's largest maximum security prison. And she also has put together this book called Letters to My Younger Self, and we've been playing excerpts of these letters, essays, poems by prisoners, the idea of reaching out to young people who might be in trouble. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Montgomery School supports WHYY, an independent school for pre-K through grade 8. Montgomery School believes when children find joy in learning, they are inspired to explore their world and succeed in their educational pursuits. Montgomery's teachers help bring out the best in each student. The school will host an open house on October 26th at 1 p.m. on their campus in Chester Springs. Details at montgomeryschool.org/admissions. Montgomery School, inspired to explore, prepared to succeed.
Philadelphia Theater Company, now in its 40th anniversary season, supports WHYY and presents Pulitzer Prize finalist Detroit, a startling new American play. This dark comedy follows Ben and Mary and the unusual couple who've moved into the deserted house next door. As they bond over backyard barbecues and booze, what starts as a neighborly friendship builds to shocking revelations and consequences. Detroit features an all-Philadelphia cast and runs October 10th through November 9th at the Suzanne Roberts Theater. Tickets at philadelphiatheatercompany.org.
The Southwest Council is proud to support WHYY. Founded in 1991 as a primary alcohol, tobacco, and other drug prevention services provider, the Southwest Council encourages health and wellness through the facilitation of prevention, education, and treatment services in Cumberland, Gloucester, and Salem County, New Jersey. More information on the Southwest Council at www.southwestcouncil.org or by calling 800-856-9609.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoene. If you're just joining us, Jane Thompson is our guest. She had her creative writing students at Great Effort Prison in Pennsylvania write letters to their younger selves, and what they wrote about revealed regrets and some painful memories and some deep introspection. We asked her to tape some of these inmates reading their essays and poems, and we are playing them in this hour of Radio Times. She hopes, and they hope, that these poems and essays can help young people that might be on the wrong path and to keep them out of prison. And again, Jane Thompson, a creative writing and English instructor at Widener University. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We just heard Termaine read a poem, but I want to do another one. It's a very different kind of poem, much more about a current event that we all sadly remember. And this is called I Can Hear the Wilderness. Listen, we're going to play an excerpt of this.
Termaine, J.H., page 158. I could hear the wilderness listen. At 3:49 a.m. on December 14th, 2012, I could hear the wilderness listen to thoughts conjured up by this gunman as he traveled in the dark from Willingboro, New Jersey to Newtown, Connecticut, with evil intentions of doing the unimaginable at Sandy Hook Elementary School as his mother lay dead in her bed. At 6:15 a.m., I can hear the wilderness listen to Caroline, age 6, hum her favorite song between mouthfuls of cereal as her legs swung back and forth enthusiastically at the thought of all the fun she would have with her friends at school. At 7:28 a.m., I could hear the wilderness listen to Justin Pinto's mother tell him he couldn't wear his favorite Victor Cruz New York Giants jersey to school today because he wanted the day before. Reluctantly, he took it off. At 7:30 a.m., I can hear the wilderness listen to the other 18 kindergartners as they sluggishly or happily rolled out of bed, brushed their teeth, ate their breakfast, hugged and told their parents, I love you, after being dropped off at school. At 9:05 a.m., I could hear the wilderness listen to the labored breathing of the gunman as he methodically loaded the 30-round magazine of his Bushmaster AR-15 assault rifle, the click and clack of metal and plastic as he checked and rechecked his Glock and six-hour 9mm pistols while he forged through the woods to Sandy Hook Elementary School. At 9:14 a.m., I can hear the wilderness listen to the pupils of Victoria Soto laughing, carrying on, singing their favorite songs as they march through the halls of Sandy Hook Elementary School. At 9:26 a.m., I can hear the wilderness listen to the explosion caused by the gunman's boot as he kicked in the front door to Sandy Hook Elementary School.
And he goes on from there at 9:28, 9:29. He ends with at 11:49, I could hear the wilderness listen as President Barack Obama paused at his press conference to wipe away the tears he couldn't hold back when describing the ages and method used to take these children's lives. And then he ends, I wonder, could the wilderness have done more than just listen? And it's so interesting and frankly quite moving to have a prisoner in a maximum security prison write about something that was just so horrifying to all of us.
Yeah, it really was. And this, I thought this was such an incredibly powerful piece. And it kind of showed also his drift for the dramatic as well. You know, the way that he makes it just so painfully real as he takes us through these
kind of reliving
minutes.
It.
Yeah.
Reliving it. And this idea of I can hear the wilderness listen.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was after just basically a prompt from Traveling Through the Dark by William Stafford, and they could choose, you know, the idea of traveling through the dark or you know, I could hear the wilderness listen, and that's all the direction I gave.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, two prompts.
Now, did you edit, I mean, did you work with them on each of these pieces? Did you kind of help them refine them, or is this pretty much what they gave you?
This is very close to what they gave me. You know, they gave me one direction. They said, just don't let us be embarrassed. Don't let us have something that's grammatically wrong that people are going to look at. But pretty much they came to me so much as you see them here. And in fact, a few times I found myself editing in one piece. I thought, oh, I should make a couple of paragraphs. This is all one paragraph. The minute I changed it, it lost its power somehow.
Oh, interesting.
Same thing happened. There's another piece that, yes, at the end there's, you know, it's a grammatical problem. But every time I fixed it, it
not
sounded,
right.
No, it just wasn't right. It sucked the beauty right out of the sentence. So I left it alone.
We have an email from Lisa. Says, I really enjoy hearing each inmate voice reading his work. It makes it so much more poignant. Are there plans for an audio version of the book? Are there? Do you know?
You know,
have you thought about that?
Well, I would love it. I would have to see what the prison would say. It even just taking in the recorder required Harrisburg had to give approval.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And then I brought in the recorder, and we were passing it from one man to the next. But I'm not allowed to be with just the one man kind of at a time doing a recording thing, which I hadn't realized. So that might be kind of a little bit tough, but that would be wonderful.
Yeah. Let me get Lucas. Looks like Lucas from North Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Lucas. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for your work, everybody. Thank you for covering this topic. I'm calling from Face Forward 2 program, and we're a program targeting young juvenile offenders, hoping to keep them out of the adult system. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit about how we can use this book as a tool to really reach these young people in this vulnerable situation.
Lucas, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I should add that Jane Thompson is a youth aid panelist for the Center for Resolution. Mm-hmm. So sounds like you and Lucas are probably on the same page.
Yeah. You know, I would love to come and talk to the young people in your group. I would absolutely love that. But we have, at the end of each section, we have writing prompts to kind of get, you know, young people to maybe think about a response to the pieces and start think about their own lives in much the same way that these men have. And for what we do at the Center for Resolutions, here in the youth aid panel hearings, we try to bring the young people back into the community. Restorative justice practices kind of thing. And I think that's how the book really can be used, is to kind of get the young people to think, so what is my place in the community? I do have a place in the community, and the community cares about me. The community wants me to come back. They're not trying to send me out. You know, so I think that the book could be used very much in that way as a tool to kind of reach out to people, to get them to kind of think twice.
Do you think of writing as therapy, or perhaps this kind of writing as a form of therapy?
I think it is. I think that, you know, I heard a story when I was at a conference recently about a veteran who had decided to commit suicide. And he wrote a letter and placed the letter on the kitchen table, and then he left to go through with his plan. And something drew him back to the house, and he went back in, he looked at the kitchen table, and there was the letter, and he read it, and he said, that poor guy.
Oh.
And he was able to kind of take himself out of that moment and look at his life and see himself kind of as an object for empathy, somebody to have empathy for. And I think that that's what writing can do, especially this type.
I do want to play another, and this is from James T. It's called American Allegory, and it's, if I can say again, a response to Charles Simic's Two Dogs. This is a little more political poem,
yes.
Would you say?
Mm-hmm.
Something a little different from what we've been hearing.
Yeah, and that is James.
And that is
very much James. And we have something in common. We both are crazy over the abolitionist John Brown.
Yeah.
So he kind of wove that in. I love that.
Let's listen. This is called American Allegory.
An American Allegory. Recall the generations of human degradation in the southlands of America, the vicious atrocities heaped upon the defenseless, loyal black slave, citizens beaten into submission in the name of democracy, the story told by the lady in the harbor, chained at the foot, going blind to justice with all that light of truth beaten down. John Brown creeping out of the shadows from New Hampshire to Virginia, striking a blow for freedom. World War II ends, evil Germany defeated, a world safe for democracy. It made me remember FDR's election and his New Deal as a child. People bursting with hope and joy along the parade route down Pennsylvania Avenue. In the dense crowd, unable to see above the thick wall of dark people, I felt a sense of fear and the panic of being knocked to the ground and trampled underfoot amid all that joy. Now today, I feel the weight and crush of this forked-tongued democracy experienced as prison, the new plantation, night coming down, John Brown entangled with soldiers' feet, kicked through the curb. That's what I keep seeing, a revolutionary flying as if he had wings, metamorphosed as today's intellectual abolitionist on a move for exposure and liberation.
And again, another reading from, yes, that's pretty powerful, from Letters to My Younger Self. That's James T., An American Allegory. And as we were saying, a very political, kind of in-your-face poem.
Yeah, yeah. And James is such an intellectual. And I think it's interesting to read an earlier piece in the book by him. It would be interesting to see what a young person would come up with. The piece where he says that he felt stupid in school. Which, and then to read this piece and to say, oh gosh, that could never have been the truth. And, looking at self-perception and how sometimes we can make decisions based on something so falsely believed about ourselves, you know. And but James is, he's something, within a couple of weeks of my teaching the class, he asked me one time, he just stopped in the middle of everything and he said, what are you doing here?
Oh, yeah. What'd you say?
He wanted to find out who I was, I think. And I said, you know, I have to think about that, because at first it was kind of, I was asked by actually Paul J.P. if I would come and just teach a class. And I really, you know, I was just there to be trained through Inside Out. And I thought, all right. So, yeah, part of it was accident, and that I kind of decided. Paul told me a very moving story of change. And I thought, oh, yeah, maybe this is something I'd like to do. And but I think the real reason I'm there is because I feel like something needs to happen. When, you know, when I was at Chester High, I keep coming back to that, but a lot of it has to do with that, I think. I literally felt like I was standing on that school-to-prison pipeline.
Right, and watching, and, yep. And watching it work.
Absolutely, and the kids were just running right beneath me, and I felt like I could do absolutely nothing to stop it. And I think that, you know, being there kind of allowed me to see the really, really big problem. I really do think it's a civil rights question, you know, one of the biggest civil rights questions of our time right now.
One of the prisoners in the beginning of the book talks about Jane's juvies. I mean, and these are the young people that you're working yeah. with, but they call them Jane's juvies.
Yeah, yeah. I know. And I call these guys, they're always the guys. The guys.
The guys.
The guys. The greater for guys. Yeah.
Let me get Warren from Westchester in on our conversation. Warren, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I am enjoying this program very much.
Thank you.
There is so much talent that you've discovered, and it was obviously very cathartic for those people who were writing it. What I'm curious about is, where do the proceeds from the sale of this book go? Are they supporting some sort of effort within the prison system? Do the inmates themselves benefit from the sale of this material and from the proceeds of this material?
Oh, thank you so
much. Yeah, Warren,
much for,
thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Thank you so much for asking that question. The publisher has done this completely. It's Serving House Books. They've done it completely pro bono. And the men receive no pay. Nobody receives anything for it. And instead, what we've decided to do is for every book sold, about 1.5 can be printed for free to be given to young people.
Mm.
And so we've been running on that system. I did have a donor, a writer in Philadelphia, who helped me buy some of the first copies because I just physically needed some, Alice Shell in Philadelphia.
Warren, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Did the prison, Greaterford, did they in any way censor or read any materials in here? Did they have to sign off on what the prisoners wrote?
They did. In fact, I sent it directly to Harrisburg. And I waited, you know, months to hear back, and I was very nervous. And all that they told me to do was to take the last names off, to be considerate of victims and victims' families. And so just have the first name, last initial, but she put her stamp of approval. She asked me to send it to the victims advocacy group, which I did as well, and they had nothing to say. Then we just went ahead. I waited a while, and then we finally went ahead with it.
And we're almost out of time here, and I do want to play one more poem, but you're basically done with this group of inmates in terms of the classes that you have had with them.
Yeah, and you know, and this is something the men themselves have decided. We could go back and do Creative Writing 3, but they have decided that we should stop and other men should get a chance to have a class. So when I go back, when the new facility at Greater Ferd, it's going to be Phoenix, I think, is finally built, I'll go in and do another class with a big group of new men.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times and for your work as well and for a chance, frankly, to hear some of these prisoners read some of their poems and essays. Thanks so much.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Jane Thompson, Senior Lecturer in English and Creative Writing at Widener University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. And we do want to close things out. This is another poem. It's The Caged Window, and it's by Chris R.W.M. And let's give it a listen. And this is from this book, Letters to My Younger Self.
Page 109, Christopher R.W.M., The Caged Window. The glass is too high for me. On tiptoes, I see frightened faces. The lucent sun fails to penetrate. The stars' luster hidden. Filtered light in the fenced-in pane. The wind sweeps little streets. Whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. I silently contemplate. Is it still there? Red brick walls, the velvet plastic covered couch, the bronze pheasant wall clock. When Nana walked through the door, staggering from a day out shopping, when anyone appreciated her labor in the core of a spiritual torment. Is time going by like a scared hare, or am I too old being born young?